This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Shumika said I had potential. Shumika said I had potential. Shumika said I had potential.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your Fetch the Box Cutters. It's year-end time of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
Hey, John.
Yes?
It's boat cutters, not box cutters.
I know.
Okay, just checking.
Can I remix? Jeez.
That just made the bullies worse. In class, I'd pass the time, drawing a slash for every time the second hand went by. A group of five done 12 times was a minute, but...
Thank you, John Perellis, for refining my approach to the one album that appeared on the year-end list of all three people on this episode of Popcast, which is, of course, Fiona Apple's Fetch the Bolt Cutters, so we're going to get into that. Before we do, though, it is time for the year-end listener mailbag. That's right, listener mailbag. First of all, if you're on the Facebook group, I see that thread is already thriving, popping, exploding. It's densely populated. But if you're not on the Facebook group, which I think is probably most of you, popcast@nytimes.com, hit us. Email us with questions about the year in music. Talk to me about the albums or songs you liked. Talk to me about your private TikTok account. I want to know all those things. We will aggregate the biggest and baddest questions, and we will come later this month and answer them all. Me, Joe, Karen, special guests, TBD, get involved. Anyway, we're here. It's Popcast After Dark. It's Verite Popcast. It's Quarantine Popcast. All your favorite categories of 2020 Popcast, all in one. John Perellis, chief pop music critic of the New York Times, is here.
I am indeed.
Lindsay Zolads, utility infielder, critic, is here, very here.
I'm so here.
We have spoken about Fiona Apple previously on Popcast. It is noteworthy that the Fiona record is the only album that appeared on all of our lists, as I mentioned. Before we get into the specifics of why that might be, I do want each of us to have an opportunity to kind of run down our list. Name all the names in case we don't get to talk about each individual album later. Name all the names, go through the album titles, and maybe just offer like a little flicker of an idea about what they made you think about. So, Lindsay, let's actually start with you.
Okay.
Fiona is your number one.
She is.
So, start from there. I assume you have the list in front of you.
I do now.
Run it down. Tell the people what you're into if they haven't read it already.
Okay, so Fiona, Fetch the Box Cutters, as we established, number one.
When she does like the, you know, when she does like the acoustic version or like the cover, when there's like the second iteration of this album, yeah, it will be called Fetch the Box Cutters.
Just totally, 100%. Yeah. All because of this. So that's my number one. We'll get to her. There's a lot to say there.
Doubtless.
My number two is Phoebe Bridgers' Punisher, which I was kind of surprised that I was the only person that had that on, because that also feels like kind of a consensus pick, but I love that record a lot. And Waxahachie, St. Cloud was my third. I just, another record I adore.
Shout out, Katie.
Yeah, always. Just consistently always great. And this record to me like took her to an even higher plane. I had Haim.
Haim.
When Haim. I'm reading, it's, I had, I'm just reading up. I had Haim, Women in Music, Part 3 as my number 4. Just a very eclectic, strong record that was better than I think a lot of people even gave it credit for, even though it was pretty acclaimed. Eve Tumor was my number 5. Heaven to a Tortured Mind, just another record that really stayed with me this year. Glammy weirdness.
I think can solve it. I can be your all, ain't no problem, baby. You can be more, but your heartless darling, oh. But I've already solved it. Say what you really mean, take it softer.
Speaking of weirdness, Charlie XCX, how I'm feeling now with my number six. I feel like I'm doing like a countdown Casey Kasem style.
That's how
here.
It should
this
be, yeah.
Exciting.
Casey Kasem, Shadow Stevens, like all that stuff.
But it's going
Bobby
the
Bones.
Wrong way. I think to build the drama,
oh, that's
I should have
true.
Started. Anyway,
yeah.
Charlie's quarantine record, which I think got to the quarantine record before it became a cliche and did it better than, you know, she's got hooks and ideas coming out of everywhere. It's Charlie, baby. Jesse Ware, what's
wait,
your
is
pleasure?
That a wait, is that a catchphrase of hers? It's Charlie,
oh, yeah.
Baby?
It's Charlie,
oh, okay.
Baby.
Oh, okay. My bad. Yeah. Sorry.
It's
apologies.
It's a countries of mine as well.
Apologies to all mainstream hyperpop fans. Sorry. My bad.
Ooh, we'll get there. The Jesse Ware record was number seven for me. I think there was a lot of disco revival going on this year for whatever reason, but this was the one that really stuck out for me. I had the Lil Uzi Vert Eternal Take, which I was also surprised not to see on your list, John, but we'll get there. Jeff Rosenstock was my number nine with No Dream, just a very cathartic, smart, intense rock record from this year that just felt really good to listen to. A lot. Perfume Genius was number 10, set my heart on fire immediately. Sort of like Waxahachie, just really consistently great artists that it almost feels redundant to put on my list every other year. But I just really, this record kind of snuck up on me later in the year too, but I couldn't leave it off. And then my number 11 was a little record called Folklore by Miss Taylor Swift.
I did not hear that record.
It snuck in right at the end for me.
I did not get a chance to listen to that record.
Yeah, it was a little indie, little underground. You might have slipped you by.
Yeah.
But
so people would have you think, FYI.
Yes. And then I stopped there because I thought 11 was a very round number.
John Pareles, I want to say, and this is actually maybe slightly more true with your songs list, which we probably won't get into at all or too much in this conversation. I thought your albums list was super wacky and wild. And your songs list was like super duper wacky and wild. So tell the people what you were jamming for albums this year.
It has been that kind of year.
Yeah, no, I was like, I texted Karen. And I was like, yo, JP is on one.
Well, okay, from the bottom, number 10. Remember, there are 30,000 other albums released this year, so number 10 isn't so bad. was Autocur, which was Sign, name of the album, the ever cryptic electronic duo. This is an instrumental album. It's disorienting and morose and weird and involving because there's all kinds of little tiny layers of morose and strange stuff going on.
And you did a rare Autocur interview this year.
I did indeed. They were very gracious and talked to me for a while and still didn't explain any of their song titles.
Yeah. Well, I feel like they just use a random symbol generator. I'm not sure if there's a, we'll get back to that. All right. Go for number nine.
Number nine, Geoti, which is what Alice Coltrane called Georgia Ann Muldrow, who's a producer instrumentalist. The album's called Mama, You Can Bet. It's basically a jazz album made all by Georgia Ann Muldrow. So she played everything. It's like Prince, except that she gets somehow the spontaneity of a jazz group, which blows my mind. It's a really warm and fuzzy and funky album. People should listen to it. Run the Jewels, John and I agreed, was a prime hip-hop album. Burna Boy, Twice as Tall, from Nigeria. Pre-quarantine, this should have been the year of Afrobeats. All these people were going to go on tour and conquer America and get wild crowds at Coachella, and instead the quarantine hit. Burna Boy's album, of the Afrobeats I've heard, is the deepest because he's introspective, he's political, he's in love. It's an album that goes all kinds of different places. And there were also, I had some regrets because last year I didn't put African Giant in my list.
Mm-hmm.
And that album might be even a little bit better than this one, but this one is
it
really
is.
Good.
It is better.
Not that you're prejudiced. Number six, Leanne LaHavas. This album came out of another year than 2020. It's an album of love songs, of exquisitely complex, syncopated, beautifully sung, wildly structured songs about a breakup. It's not a 2020 album. It doesn't have any larger malaise. It's just beautiful musicianship. Number five, a new songwriter, Bob Dylan, Rough and Rowdy Ways.
What are these dark days I see in this world so badly bent? How can I redeem the time, a time so idly spent? How much longer can it last? How long can it go on? I embrace my love, put down my head, and I cross the Rubicon.
Number four, that obscure indie songwriter Taylor Swift. Number three, Moses Sumney, which is a 20-song suite called Gray. It's about masculinity. It's about power. It's about melting songs down and turning them into something else halfway through and having songs talk to each other. In this weird amorphous year, it felt like it was a very amorphous musical statement. Fiona Apple with her box cutter. And number one, an album I think song for song is as strong as anything I heard this year. Sufjan Stevens, The Ascension, which is his giant armored electropop album, and it's about revelation and it's about catastrophe. And each song, I reviewed it, I put it away, there were other things to listen to. I went back 4 months later, every song was still in my head. And that's a really good test of an album for me.
I'm going to run down my list. I'll do it the other way. I will do it the anti-Casey Kasem way. Lindsay, I don't want you to be out here alone.
Thank you. Thank you, John.
Let's go. Let's get it in. Sam Hunt, Southside. Number one, this is an album that was a long time in the making, as was my feature on Sam, back when we did those kind of things. A very, very savvy combination of classic country songwriting and structural approach with innovative production, hip-hop influenced and beyond textures. Very, very sharp record. Number two, Rina Sawayama. Sawayama is the name of the album. Since we're probably going to talk about Charlie, I'm sure we'll talk about kind of like art pop as a concept, no Lady Gaga. This is an album that is both kind of like massive scaled, like almost like a little bit like dunka dunka, but at the same time, like just very, very savvy in how it pilfers late 90s into mid 2000s pop, arena rock, rap rock,
if I can say, it's also kind of nuts.
The album?
Yes.
It's way nuts.
Yeah.
It's way nuts. It's way nuts. Number three, Rod Wave, Pray for Love. So all rappers preoccupied with singing. Here is a singer who is preoccupied with rapping and hip-hop texture, hip-hop subject matter. And it sort of ends up being kind of a blues record. It's a really, really beautiful, really sad record. Even the optimistic songs are sad. Number four, Jay Electronica, A Written Testimony. There's actually two Jay Electronica records that came out this year. Hackers unearthed his long-shelved debut album. That album is also very good. But A Written Testimony is fascinating. It's got nothing to do really with 2020. It's a very almost like 1989 to 1991 classic, religiously-minded hip-hop record. And then Jay-Z, uncredited, just shows up on like six or seven songs and is better than he's been on the last four albums. So go check that out. Number five, Run the Jewels, RTJ4. JP and I both had this on our list. Just a scuzzy, messy, anarchic, frankly, like a industrially sloppy album. That's also a lot of fun. Number six, Fiona Apple. Number seven, Pop Smoke, Shoot for the Stars, Aim for the Moon. This is the first and probably, unfortunately, the last album from Pop Smoke, who was killed this year. A very good example of a New York rapper emanating from a more traditional street-oriented style, in his case, drill, into something a little bit more gruffly melodic. This was a big record this year, and it portended bigger things for him down the line, unfortunately. Number eight, Flo Milli, Ho, Why Is You Here? Flo Milli,
yes,
great fun rapper, great rapper, very playful, very bratty. I struggle sometimes with the language around how Flo Milli and a few other folks of that generation rap. It's very talky. It's kind of like aware of the beat, but not beholden to the beat. I like how kind of like thrown together this record feels. Number 9, Pow Fu. The EP is called Poems of the Past. This is just very like post Lil Peep, sad boy, emo, rap, indie pop. Very, very well-written stuff. Number 10, this, and I should say, on number 10, I pick this before the Grammys controversy, if anybody cares about that kind of thing. Justin Bieber, Changes. As anyone who listens to podcasts knows, I have been begging, pleading, groaning for Justin Bieber to make an R&B record for years, and now he finally made it, and I think it's very good. It's very understated. He's not like a powerhouse singer, but he does kind of find the pocket really well. And then he had like a whole mess when he didn't get nominated for Best R&B Album at the Grammys, and kind of like did like the Anti Macklemore thing, and it was an unfortunate ninth inning twist to this whole thing. Number 11. Chris Stapleton, Starting Over. Chris Stapleton, I want to say I was early on and I was hot on, and then I got cold. And the part of the reason I got cold was there was something that felt perfunctory about how he was using his voice. When I put this record on, I got hit with this howl, and I was like, damn, he really brought it back. So the songs are really good, but the voice is really where it's at on this. Get involved. Number 12, the first of two Bad Bunny records that came out this year. It's YHLQMDLG. I am not going to say the full name.
Que ningún baboso se le pegue. La disco se prende cuando ella llegue. A los hombres los tienes de hobby. Una malcria como Nairobi. Y tú la ves bebiendo de la botella. Los nenes y las nenas quieren con ella. Tiene más de 20, me enseñó la cédula. Hey.
Bad Bunny is often portrayed as someone who is either too avant or too futurist for the space that he's in, or, you know, is constantly forward-looking and a renegade. But this album showed that he was paying attention to all the classics. He knew all the right stuff. He grew up listening to all that stuff and wanted to pay homage to it as well. Number 13, and just because I like them and him next to each other, it's Beach Bunny. Now, Miss Honeymoon, anybody who was going to concerts with me, and I'm sure JP was at these concerts, or Lindsay, you were probably at some version of these concerts in like 2008 to 2011, you know, where it's like Kickball Katie, Dum Dum Girls, etc. This particular moment of kind of like lightly garage punk, lightly surf punk, there were like 50 bands like that that kind of faded away. Beach Bunny kind of brings that energy back. But I think Lily Trufilio, who is the lead singer, her voice is just like super, super sweet and really a signature and elevates these songs to another level. If you look at my list online, you will see there are 27 other albums that I just vomed out at the end, which I will not read.
I'm glad you were so decisive, John.
I think it's, if we're going to be definitive, I need people to know that, yes, I did listen to the Lil Durk and Lauren Massetti record, okay? I did do that. Let's start with Fiona, our common ground, and then we'll start with some common ground. We'll go to some albums that were on only one of our lists, and then I want to talk big picture about what the album means. JP, talk to us a little bit about how this Fiona album fits in with the larger Fiona project.
Well, it's more unhinged than any of them. It's noisier. She is not holding back. She's always been pretty reclusive, but apparently has gotten more so in the 8 years since the previous album. And she's also gotten much less concerned about verse, chorus, verse in a song. The great thing about this album is that you never know which road or which off-road direction the songs are going to take. They keep morphing all the way through. They follow her mood, and her mood, shall we say, swings. And she's also banging on everything in sight, pots and pans, the walls, the piano. And she's also singing much more raw and raggedly and deeply than she has before. And she was always a great singer. So she's pushing extremes in every direction, structural extremes. She's pushing sonic extremes, and she's pushing emotional extremes, but she's also controlling her narrative, which is the narrative of someone who is by now a creature of Hollywood, a creature who understands her privilege, a creature who's still dealing with being underestimated, and she's fighting back at all of it.
Lindsay, can you talk about the way in which the context of this album's release enhanced the experience of the album itself? This is maybe the first big record that came out during quarantine that people were like trapped in their house for. It's not that it wasn't a great record or it wouldn't have been a great record under normal circumstances, but there was something about, what was this, like 4 weeks in or 5 weeks in? There's something about it that felt really gratifying and kind of like unleashing about it. But I wonder if you can talk about the context and how that shaped your and the world's reception of it.
I have a very vivid memory of the first time I listened to this record. I was in my apartment, as I was for the entire year.
Where do you remain?
I was in the front hallway, and I had just had, right before the record was sent to me, I got a delivery of groceries, and I was wiping them down with a disinfectant wipe because I wasn't sure whether or not that was still a thing we were supposed to do. There was conflicting evidence, but I was going to be safe, so I just brought the Fiona record into my hallway and was just wiping down groceries. And in the middle of the first song, I, by the moment in the opening song, I Want You to Love Me, there's a sort of melodic swoop. And one of the changes that John was talking about comes in where her voice just transforms in this way. And that was the moment I was like, this record is going to be with me for a really long time. Like, I just had, was like, okay, she brought it here. But something about that feeling of uncertainty and confusion and stuck at homeness that we were all feeling, she, of course, did not make this during the pandemic, had been working on this record for years and years, and is never someone who, especially now, is never someone who's trying to fit something within a trendy context of whatever else is happening. She's very much her own solar system at this point and yet it just like struck this universal nerve with people, because I think it is so idiosyncratic and personal, but at the same time, it's really resilient and homemade in this way that I think we were all sort of looking for things to do within our own home. And it was almost accidental, like the resonance of it. But I think too, it's one of those records where when you dig as deep as she's digging on this, she's coming at something really universal and human. It feels like a therapy session to me. That's how I've described it to people. Like, it feels like a free hour of therapy listening to this record, which again was something we all kind of needed.
Don't tell my therapist that.
Don't tell my therapist that. But
everybody text your therapist and be like, you can't charge me anymore because the Fiona record is free, FYI.
Listen, my first session after this record came out was something else. This for me, like, this was a year where my number one was kind of a no-brainer. Like, I just felt like for all the other records that really did help me through this year and did kind of speak to something I was feeling, this just felt just on a plane above that. And I think it's something, you know, as a fan of hers for a long time, it feels like the culmination of a sense of freedom that she had been longing for since her debut album and had not been able to quite get in a mainstream context or on a major label or in the ways that I think she still is on a major label, but was able to carve out this sense of freedom that she has been clamoring for half her life on these records, and to finally hear her sort of reinvent her approach in this way and have it feel so personal and so new. I don't know. It's amazing to me. I love it.
My memory of those first few weeks, apart from like fear and anxiety, was that kind of that steady dullness of like, huh, tomorrow's going to be a lot like today, huh? And then like the next day's probably going to be a lot like tomorrow. And then the day after that, there was this sense that things were not evolving or changing and that we were kind of trapped in amber in a way. And more than any other record this year, and I think a lot of kind of like popular records from this time period were kind of a wash for me because they didn't do this thing that Fiona's record did, which was remind me that there is spiritual, creative, cultural, emotional, dynamic life out there. It was just a literal reminder of everything that had been kind of like taken away for those few weeks. Even something like The Weeknd's album, which I liked a lot. It's a really enjoyable record, but there's still something like slightly synthetic about that record. And it came out in a similar time period. Whereas this Fiona record, you're like, oh, there is an access to a rawness that existed prior to all this. And like, hopefully will like continue to exist after this.
Yeah. Like we said, it is the one record that's on all three of our lists. I think in a lot of ways, I think it's going to top a lot of critical lists this year or be towards the top. It's odd to me how quickly she's gone from sort of this, you know, music industry outcast in a lot of ways to now this record being the quote unquote consensus choice, as close to one as there can be this year. And that just feels a little surreal to me as someone who's followed her entire career through critical embraces and rejections in a lot of ways. It's funny to arrive at this place for this record where she's at in her career now. It's very satisfying, but at the same time, I think a lot of people were surprised that she was not nominated for the Album of the Year Grammy, and there was kind of people acted like that was a snub. I was like, you thought this record was going to get nominated right for Album of the Year? Like, have you listened to some of these songs? It is confrontational to people in power. She did not forget any of the slights that, you know, that are in the past. And I think it, particularly to me, the way that it deals with the post-Me Too, the aftermath of all of the upheaval of the past few years, not in a way that's grandstanding or feels like it's trying to speak to a larger trend, but feels incredibly personal, incredibly questioning just what is male power in the world and why what role did that play in thwarting some of her creative freedoms earlier in her career. Like, they're not going to nominate that for Album of the Year. Like, that would be crazy. Sorry.
That's
what I love about it.
I also do think like the consent, like critical consensus is not the same thing as like Grammy voter awareness.
No.
I feel like the average Grammy voter is probably like, oh yeah, maybe I'll get around to listening to that. Whereas the person who writes music criticism is like, holy shit, Fiona Apple has a record out? Like, oh my God. Like it's just like the interest pools of those two different groups of people just are far apart, as, you know, the last 60 years of music criticism would indicate. JP, let's pivot and talk about a record that was on both of our lists. Let's listen to A Few Words for the Firing Squad, Radiation, off of RTJ4 by Run the Jewels.
It'd be a lie if I told you that I ever disdain the fortune and fame, but the presence of the pleasure never abstained me from any other pain. When my mother transitioned to another plane, I was sitting on a plane, telling her to hold on, and she tried hard, but she just couldn't hang. Been 2 years, true fears, I'll probably never be the same. This is just a chore not to let myself go insane. It's crippling, make you wanna lean on a cup up. But my queen say she need a king, not another junkie rapper fiend. Friends tell her he could be another Malcolm.
This podcast is supported by Reimagining Democracy for a Good Life, a podcast that asks, how do we build a radically inclusive, thriving, multiracial democracy? Longtime equity advocate Angela Glover Blackwell looks at movement, struggle, and progress in Los Angeles to see what it can teach the nation about building a democracy that represents everyone. Reimagining Democracy for a Good Life is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. I have been trying to understand changes in migration. So I traveled with photographer Federico Rios to the Darien Gap, this hot, mountainous, 70-mile stretch of jungle straddling the border of Colombia and Panama.
We're hiking through a river, just like covered in mud.
Many used to think that this route was impassable, but thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the Darien, almost all in the hopes of making it to the United States. We spent 9 days hiking through the gap and weeks building trust and relationships with migrants, with smugglers, with migration authorities to even be able to do this reporting. We interviewed hundreds of people who have made this journey to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths to find a new life. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
JP, why did this album speak to you? And how did you feel about it in the broader Run the Jewels catalog?
I think it's as strong as any of them, but they're all really strong. They all make a big racket, and they're all really smart underneath the big racket. Sometimes the sexism and the boasting of some of their earlier stuff docked them a notch for me. Here, obviously, they're more mature. They're grown-ups. They're still completely boisterous and obstreperous and obnoxious and angry. And they're looking outside themselves, I guess. And that's what finally put it onto one of my top 10 lists. Also, their production is always great. One of my hobby horses you've heard me rattle on before on podcast is, you know, why is so much production now a bunch of 808 sounds? It's like there are a million other things you can do, and they do maybe, you know, 20,000 of them on this record.
And that's LP and the guys who work with him. This is another record. It's interesting. I didn't do this intentionally, but I think this is another record that greatly benefited from the context of the year without being made as a reaction to the context of the year. Here's a record that came out over the summer, right kind of in the window of the racial justice protests. Run the Jewels have always been politically engaged. This was a year that needed a Run the Jewels record. It just so happened that Run the Jewels already had one that was coming out. And it's funny, someone was asking me the other day, is there a sound of the quarantine record, or did 2020 have a particular corona era sound? And we'll talk about Taylor and we'll talk about Charlie, about albums that were pretty much made in this context. But what I do think that this year did was amplify how we heard other kinds of records. If you listen to RTJ4, LP remains like an incredible, scabrous, dissolute, sharp-tongued rapper. Killer Mike, very, very emphatic storyteller, a great public servant in the context of being a rapper. Hearing them kind of like joust back and forth with each other is just a real pleasure, real, real pleasure this year. JP, let's talk about an album on your list that no one else voted for. You can pick.
I can pick?
Yeah, you should pick. You should pick.
I'm looking at the list here. Well, let's talk about that Moses Sumney album, because it's strange and beautiful and quiet. And I think that one reason it ended up on my list is that we had the context to listen to it. There wasn't a lot of noise on the street to distract from it. You could sit and focus on this album, which is what you have to do. You could let yourself be swept up in it. And I mean, I spent a lot of the year sitting at my desk with headphones on, listening to stuff, looking out the window. And something like this had time to sink in. It's a strange puzzle of an album. It's got a lot of pieces that you realize at the end have interlocked along the way, even more than the Taylor Swift album. And
wait, can we listen to something off the Moses Sumney record? Let's listen to Two Dogs, which is the first song off of the second part of the record.
Oh, the backyard sang a chorus of bats from yin and yang. They played angel and demon, but oh, I love them just the same.
JP, talk about that interlocking, because this does feel, I don't know if I like this record quite as much as the prior Moses Sumney record, but I did. It's interesting to hear what you say about it demanding a certain kind of patience, because I think as I was listening to it in preparation for today, I was like, huh, I wish my brain had been quieter this year. And I was like, my immediate thought is that when I was really allowing myself to be at peace, I felt this record seeping in a much more intense way than it had earlier in the year.
Well, I think you've probably said it. The record meditates in a way. It meditates at times, and it rushes forward like a cataract at times. And you don't know when the changes in momentum are going to occur. He does have a totally angelic, androgynous voice that's just like otherworldly. He also occasionally gets funky. And In a way, it's a lot like the Fiona Apple record in that you don't know where a song is going to go, and you don't know what's going to change behind him. I found myself listening this year a lot more to textures and arrangements and structures or melting structures than I think I have before, just because of the circumstances of the quiet around us.
I'd like to talk about a record that I was the only person who voted for, and that is my number one album, Sam Hunt Southside. And I just like, what are you guys doing? What's happening? What's going on? Let's listen to Sinning With You.
I never felt like I was sinning with you. Always felt like I could talk to God in the morning. I knew that I would end up with you. Always felt like I could talk to God in the morning. If it's so wrong, why did it feel so right? If it's so wrong, why did it never feel like sinning with you?
So here's a song that made me cry this year. So here's the thing about Sam Hunt, and as we have talked about before on Popcast and certainly in my writing, I have long admired Hunt's approach to country music, his affection for hip hop, the way that he uses it carefully in his songwriting and production choices. But I remember the first time I listened to this record before, like way before it came out, my initial reaction to it was, huh, this is pretty square. He's just doing like some straight country songs. And it turned out to be, of course, much more rich than that. But the thing that I think people forget about Sam Hunt is he is going to do a bone dry country song as well, if not better, than most of the people for whom that is their full-time job. And for him, it's just a skill set and an occasional side hustle. But he still does it better than most of the folks who do it day in, day out. He's incredibly careful as far as songwriting goes, very particular with imagery. And this album, even though this has interesting songs, Hard to Forget is kind of like the obvious song, which is built on a sample of an older country song, you know. But to me, the songs on this album that really, really connected were, in a way, the driest. And that's Sinning With You, that's 2016, so on and so forth. It's that commitment to convention and being so good at it while also having this other thing that you do really well, that was the most impressive for me.
The songs are you know, terse Hank Williams country.
Yeah, yeah.
But the sound palette is the hip-hop universe. There's more to be done in this realm. I hope somebody takes him up on it.
Yeah, I'm actually about to write about someone who is, FYI. So just, you know, be on the lookout for that.
I'll say I really do like this record. Something about him that, and I don't think I'm alone in this, that like keeps me at a slight distance is the kind of like early Drake, like, girl, you're prettiest without any makeup on, kind of I know what's best for you vibe that I just like personally find is kind of distancing for me as a listener. But there's a charm to the fact that he has a lot of the same flaws and strengths as Drake, quite literally.
Musically and emotionally. Yeah, and there's the one song on this album, That Ain't Beautiful, where it like kind of toes a weird line, like where you're just like, is this a character? Is this a scold?
And it's like a little bit sweet, but a little bit of offensive at the same time. And I
agree.
I sort of think of him as almost like the male Kelsey Ballerini. I don't know if that's totally left field, but that was one of the records. The Kelsey record just missed my list. That was one of my honorable mentions that I think in a weird way, she's doing something similar of trying to open up the country traditional song in a way that lets in modern influences, lets in pop, lets in a little bit of hip hop cadence. And I sort of heard her riffing on the Ariana sound a little bit on this record. That
interesting.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I think of them as kind of complementary in some way, and both good records.
Well, here's the thing that gets me about a lot of mainstream country is it's the 80s again, and at least Sam Hunt is the 21st century. A lot of the mainstream country is all of the tricks that worked in arena rock, all the tricks that worked for Bon Jovi are now working for
Florida Georgia Line. Yeah. And that's not even because one of the dudes is like a QAnon dude. That's like, that's not even connected to that. It's just, sorry. Lindsay, do you want to talk about an album that only you voted for?
Yeah.
Which doesn't make it less special.
Thank you. I needed that reminder. Let's talk about Phoebe. Because I'm curious what y'all were thinking. That one also felt to me, I don't want to say it's a consensus thing, but I think that was a record that seemed to mean a lot to a lot of people this year. And that I think also, again, not to, you know, if we can get through the rest of this episode without saying even more so now than ever, it would be a triumph. But
yes.
I do think this was another record that, while it was not made during the pandemic, there was a specific emotional palette that just made a lot of sense being received into the moment that it was received into. And I think Phoebe has just become such a good, I guess she's a celebrity, forward-facing figure. She really seems like someone who rose to this occasion of internet savvy, hilarious, but also really emotionally direct and literate songwriter working in this space with both a knowingness and a sincerity that really makes her unique. I just felt like this record was a huge step forward for her in every way, and just feels so specific and so personal to her, but resonated on such a larger scale with a lot of people. I was talking about this with someone else today, actually, that there's something about this record that's almost internal dialogue-esque. You know, it has the feel of, it's very nocturnal at times. Like, it feels like she's just up late with insomnia, just kind of the thoughts running through her head, walking around by herself. And something about that, you really feel like you're in her private sphere in these songs. And some of that is the production, I think, really augments that feeling. It's very amniotic almost. And there's a lot of just atmosphere to it. There are big kind of orchestrated moments, but by and large, I think of this record as being kind of hermetic, kind of personally sealed in this way that so many of us were just kind of listening to the thoughts in our head. But there's, I don't know, there's just a way that she's able to capture that feeling of both like larger generational dread, but also the really hyper-specific problems that someone is going through on an intimate level that just felt pretty accurate to how it feels to be alive right now.
Okay, I'm going to wade into this dangerous territory.
Go on.
I'm going to wade in. I have two sub-subjects I would like to touch.
Okay.
One, which is not about whether I like the record or not. Big year for Phoebe Bridgers on TikTok. Huge year. Motion sickness, you know, there's not an indie rock 22-year-old anywhere in the country who didn't do that dance to Motion Sickness on TikTok. I see you. I honor you. That's number one. Number two, like the idea of Phoebe Bridgers as a meme for kind of like hetero men to be like, I like Phoebe Bridgers, therefore I'm someone you should date. Or I tried really hard to find this one. I think I forgot to favorite it. It was someone who was basically like, can someone show me like a guy who doesn't have Phoebe Bridgers in his top five because I want to date someone who's not like emotionally and mentally unwell.
Don't we all? Amen.
So big year for Phoebe Bridgers in the conversation. That's the setup.
Okay.
Here's the pivot. And this is something that I may have alluded to on past episodes, but it's something that's been on my mind a lot because I think it's increasingly relevant. Phoebe brings this up for me to a degree. Megan brings this up for me. Lindsay, earlier in the episode, you sort of asked me why Uzi wasn't on my list. And I think it's because Uzi kind of fits in this category for me as well. Even like someone like Luke Combs kind of does in a way. And that is artists who I think if you want to put a phrase on it, I'm conceptually into. Artists I am happy to see win. This is like a category of artists who maybe I think are not fully at their full potential, or their public facing persona is maybe a click more interesting than the music that they are putting out. For all of the artists that I just mentioned, that's kind of how I feel about them. And I think I wouldn't be supportive if I thought that there wasn't an upside, if I thought that there wasn't a positive direction that they were heading in. But I do think sometimes what's happening with these artists, and again, Lindsay, I think Phoebe sort of lands here for me, is that I feel like the idea of Phoebe Bridgers, the kind of cult of Phoebe Bridgers, the energy around Phoebe is maybe one or two steps ahead from where I feel like the songwriting has been. So it's someone I'm conceptually into. It's someone I'm excited about, but I'm not totally there yet.
That's interesting because that is actually how I felt about her before this record. I did not connect with her debut album, even though, you know, I don't think there was as much hype around that one as there was this, but it took me to the Boy Genius EP with Lucy Dacus and Julian Baker that I
Julian
think came
Baker.
Out last year.
Julian
yeah, like
Baker.
She's her next year. We'll perhaps be talking about her. But I really loved Phoebe's songs on that EP, and I felt like that was kind of a bridge into her sensibility. But I do think you're right. Like, this felt like a year where even the kind of like indie stan army was coalescing this consensus around. And, you know, I think for me, her music really transcended that meme. You know, I think in some ways, like, Mitski was last year's version of this. One of my favorite songs on this record is the title track, where I feel like she is grappling with her fame and grappling with what it means to be a public figure. And in this way, having this spiritual communion with Elliot Smith and kind of talking to him through this song. And that was just one of the many moments that felt like there was something just special going on this record for me.
I was going to say, we should listen to Punisher. The album's called Punisher. We should listen to the song Punisher. Let's catch a little bit of that. I want to talk about two albums. You know, we've talked about albums that were made in other contexts that made sense in the current context. Let's talk about two albums that were made in the current context and kind of did similar but different things. And I'm talking about Taylor Swift Folklore, and I'm talking about Charlie XCX, How I'm Feeling Now. Charlie dropped first. It's number six on your list, Lindsay. Can you explain a little bit about what of the current moment do you think this album captured? And I also want to say, for everybody on the podcast Facebook group who is always agonizing about my relationship to Charlie XCX's music, I do actually quite like this record, and it was really like probably just the tier below the records that I put in the honorable mention. It was like very, very close. It didn't quite hold up. So that's, I'm just talking to y'all. That's it. Okay, Lindsay. Go in, please.
All right. It's Lindy, baby. Yeah. I did not engage with any of the sort of quarantine open process making of this record. I was not in the Zoom when she announced it. Like, what is the line between sort of gimmickry and genuine response to these conditions in making the art? And I think sometimes for some people, like, maybe the Charlie record toed the line, and I, you know, the rollout, the quarantine rollout, I was not particularly interested in, but I do think that this record, again, kind of spoke to me in this way, in a very specific, also very 2020 way. Like, this was the record that I listened to when I was running more than ever, because I, like everyone else, I had to cancel my gym membership and tried to take up running. And
see,
Charlie,
you don't have to you don't have to cancel your gym membership if you don't have one.
That is
see?
True. That is
see?
True.
Yeah,
Galaxy
that's
Brain.
That's a bar right there. Yeah.
But there is just a sort of intensity to this record. I mean, I am a Charlie fan by and large, not uncritical of it. I did not like the last record that much. Charlie, you know, loved Pop 2, but I think the past releases that she's done, the past few, have gone really heavy on guest artists, have really like pushed the idea of collaboration to this almost like communal, collective, unconscious pop that she's making. That was something I loved about pop too, but this record feels incredibly about her and focusing back on her as a solo artist.
Should we listen to I Finally Understand?
Sure.
Yeah, let's listen to I Finally Understand. It's like in the middle of the album.
The walls are all gone, deeply melting down. Liquid in my hands, liquid in my mouth. Footage on my phone, did it with your tone. And now it's sticking close and I understand. Baby, I love you bad. It's lately, I finally understand. But maybe this feeling that I found might kill me. Put me in the ground.
Speaking of therapy, another song that references
yep.
therapy. But I, you know, I think what may have been missing from some of the last Charlie records were that, you know, she's obviously an expert songwriter at this point and can sometimes maybe get lost in like the craftsmanship of becoming this like pop auteur. I feel this record to be very personal and sort of about, at the same time, going through this existentially terrifying and confusing situation, which she discusses really well on Anthems, which is one of my favorite songs. But also it's a record about navigating a long-term relationship and kind of all these anxieties about, do you still like me? The song Detonate, like, am I going to F this up? It's my tendency to, like, what do I, you know, there's a lot of just personal kind of working through of emotions that I think I had been missing from some of her stuff before. And again, that just feels like something a lot of people were going through. This so easily could have just been a gimmicky thing. And I think just through her songwriting, through the other collaborators that I think kind of like pushed her sound to an extreme. And there's just like moments when she's talking about missing her friends and wanting to go out and party. And that, you know, as banal as that seems, that's like when I look back on this year, that is a feeling that's going to resonate and that is still going to exist in these songs that I think still will have a lot of life in them beyond 2020.
I hope I don't start seeing footage of like Charlie XCX like breaking quarantine and partying and like, you know,
never.
Doing like a hype house, getting her house shut down for violating the rules. I hope that doesn't happen because the emotional content in this record does feel pure in that way.
Yeah.
She does seem sensible too.
Yeah.
I hope so.
She brings the party wherever she is, I would say.
Fair enough.
I interviewed A.G. Cook this year, one of her collaborators, and talked to Charlie too. She was so happy to be talking to somebody. She said, I really wanted to talk about working with this guy. The thing about the Taylor Swift record and this record is they don't sound alike. There is not a quarantine sound.
No.
They're like two opposite extremes. Charlie's this electronic, flickering, attention deficit computer universe. And Taylor Swift is acoustic instruments and crunchy granola. People make records now anyway by sending files to each other. So part of it is that the quarantine in a way just accelerated the 21st century methods, just solidified them.
JP, the question I was going to ask you, and I think you're heading in this direction anyway, so I'll just drop it, which is the Charlie XCX record, even though the causation and the subject matter may have been particular to the moment, it still sounds like a Charlie XCX record. Taylor Swift made a record that only partly sounded like a Taylor Swift record, as we have historically understood it. What do you think isolation, quarantine, whatever, gave Taylor that she did not have before or didn't use before if she had?
Well, I watched the concert explanation documentary, and she said she'd always recorded in a professional studio before, which is pretty amazing in these times when everybody records at home. So she was always on the clock before. You know, she was always paying for studio time. And to work in a home studio has to change your sense of time and organization and how leisurely you can be about a song. I mean, it takes pressure off in a way.
Was that what made her more willing to be experimental with production? Did it affect the structures of her songwriting? How do you think that translated on Folklore?
I don't think it affected the structures of her songwriting that much. She's still verse, chorus, verse, strange bridge. The songs are very traditional. Every word is etched. Every word is poised and pointed. The sound of it is sort of woolly and elaborate and intricate in ways that reflect her collaborators. Inside each one of those songs, if you made those songs with Max Martin or a producer like that, she could be singing the same thing. She could be singing the same melodies and verses and choruses. It would be more legible as an old-fashioned pop Taylor Swift record. I mean, the quietude of quarantine gave her a chance to do acoustic instruments, gave her a chance to let Aaron Dessner of The National do all of his like minimalistic patterns within patterns. The other thing is, she wasn't about to go tour arenas. She already knew she wasn't going to tour arenas with these songs. These songs don't have to be legible from the bleachers. These songs only have to be legible to the person who's listening to them with maybe their pod. And I think that reshapes the song. That means you can do intricacies instead of big blaring hooks.
The song has different needs.
Yeah. And because it was made in those circumstances, because it was made in isolation and quietude, it wasn't made to be bounced off a giant audience.
Let's listen to one of my favorite songs on the record, which is This Is Me Trying.
You're a flashback and a film reel on the one street in my town.
So, rather famously, I did not, this is maybe not my favorite Taylor Swift record.
really?
Yeah, I don't, you may have heard.
I'm glad you got to hear it, John.
Yeah, I did. In the last 40 minutes, I've managed to finally get around to it. So, for me, a lot of the things that you're talking about, JP, just felt inconsistent with what I think Taylor is best at. And so, I think one of the things that I was struggling with this record was getting these flickers of, oh, it's that Taylor. And then all of a sudden it would just be like washed out by some Dessner thing or something else. You're right in that the unburdening brought on by the circumstance did allow her to try this different thing. And also I want to emphasize one thing that I've always been impressed with about Taylor is I think she's willing to make different sounding albums. I do think Reputation sounds different from Red, which sounds different than Fearless, which sounds different from the self-titled debut album. I think, unfortunately, there's been a general movement away from pop star experimentation at a high level. I think most super famous people are really just doing really incremental stuff. And this is a good example of someone who's very, very famous being like, the hell with it. I'm just going to try something that's very different.
This is her anti. This is her Rihanna's anti. It is. It's like, I'm going to do what I want. You know, I'm going to follow these sounds. You know, they're not the big, brightly outlined sounds that you're used to from me, but I'm kind of curious about them.
Lindsay, talk to us a little bit about how folklore pulses through your veins.
Well.
Yeah.
You know, in going back to the idea of the quarantine aesthetic, I think for me, you know, this record's on my list. As I wrote in my blurb, I still have my qualms with it. I don't think it's a perfect record.
I thought you were just trolling me. I couldn't tell. Like, you know, it's just,
I added a number 11 just to troll.
I was not lost on me. Just FYI. It was not lost on me. Okay.
But no, I think the songwriting on this album is excellent and makes me excited for the next chapter of Taylor. I think she's really coming into like a new form of her power as a more mature songwriter now, and that's exciting. I think for me, I wish that the production on this record was even more stripped down because I think there's something being quieter than her pop music doesn't necessarily mean it's not overproduced. And I think, you know, we've talked about this on the Taylor podcast, but like I'm also not a big National person. I do not always love the way that this record sounds. You know, my dream, much in the way that people are like the fabled Taylor Swift country album that they want her to make, you know, next, I just want like the acoustic album. Like if this whole record sounded like Betty, I think it would have been closer to number one for me. But there's something about the immediacy gets buried a little bit in all the textures. It feels a little overproduced at times, even though it's trying to sound underproduced.
That's it. Mm-hmm. Like literally, I can't believe. Did anybody write that in their piece?
I didn't.
That's the whole thing right there. What you just said. It wants to pretend to be underproduced, but is in fact overproduced.
She's making all the creative decisions here, but the fault feels with just the sonic kind of palette. Because I think the men.
Just
leaning into my anti-male stance.
We're at minute 60 of the episode. Like anyone who's come this far knows that we know it's the men's fault. And I agree with you about Betty. Betty's on my songs list.
Yeah.
Because Betty is kind of like platonic ideal Taylor.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Well, you should check out the documentary where she just plays with Antonoff and Dessner, guitar, piano, and third person, and your overproduction is gone.
I'll take your word for it. Okay, I want to talk a little bit broader for a second. I've struggled this year to listen to albums. That's only partly to do with kind of like the circumstances of the world. I was very, very drawn to TikTok, as everybody knows. I'm experiencing things one single at a time, one song at a time, one snippet at a time. The idea of listening to an album, like even like someone like Lil Baby, who had a bunch of singles I really liked, I found it really challenging to slog through those albums. And many people have already arrived at this. You know, I'm not original in this idea, but I'm starting to wonder about the utility of the album. Not for every artist, but at least for some artists who maybe thrive in shorter or more constrained contexts. And I wonder if this year changed for either of you your thoughts about the album just as a package and as a vehicle. Because I felt as I was putting this list together, even though I have this long list of albums, I wouldn't say that I was particularly sold on the album, quote unquote.
I had the opposite reaction this year, which was that it was a good year for albums. Fiona Apple's album is better as an album. You're not going to pop out a song and say, that's the song. Unless, of course, you're the Grammys. The Moses Sumney album is an album. And the Taylor Swift album, even though maybe you could cut one song or something, two or three songs, is an album. It's made to have the songs talk to each other. I mean, hip-hop was a singles medium. Hip-hop never evolved as an album medium. But singer-songwritering, if I can make up that verb.
Well, Dr. Dre would disagree with you, but I take the point.
I mean, the Phoebe Bridgers album is better as an album, even though it's got some killer songs on it. But it's better when the songs are, you know, revving up with Kyoto and being quiet with the garden. The contrasts really add up to more than the individual song. So I think the quarantine actually may have given the album a little breathing room.
I agree more with JP on this. I felt even more so it was a year that was something I was sort of craving in my listening. Like, John, you were talking at the beginning about the feeling in the beginning that every day was the same as the day before, and just time has sort of become this huge sweeping morass that I can't find myself in. And there was something really kind of nice about listening to something with a beginning, middle, and end that took you on some sort of journey that was then over and had a narrative arc. I think I found myself gravitating a lot towards that kind of stuff this year. I watched a lot more movies than TV or anything like that, which is just kind of my taste anyway, and probably not indicative of a larger culture, it seems. But I think I really sort of needed those aesthetic experiences that went on for a duration of time and then were over. And an album, I think by definition, that.
So I think what I'm hearing from both of you is that I need to revisit ADHD medication. That sounds like that's my main takeaway. Okay, to close out, let's all pick a song from an album we have not talked about on our list. Let's just like, because I want to give a little bit more flavor for people. Lindsay, talk about an album that only you picked, and let's just play a song real fast, give people a little taste.
So I really loved this record by Jeff Rosenstock called No Dream. And I think it's hard to pick a song. I think we're going to go with the title track because, again, this just something about this year felt like you were just sleepwalking through half of the time and kind of things didn't feel like they were actually happening and you needed someone to kind of shake you, even though no one could grab you by the shoulders because it was not socially distanced, and say, this is really happening. And this is one of those records, which again, for the millionth time, was not made like for the pandemic, but just had a real timeliness that it feels like an alarm clock spiritually and emotionally and just volume wise in so many other ways. Interestingly, like, I don't think he has a lot in common sonically with Run the Jewels, but I think this record may have kind of done for me, which I found the latest Run the Jewels record to like leave me a little cold, I have to say. I like them a lot, but they would admit themselves they've now made their same record like four times and kind of they're just
down to the album cover. Yeah. Down to the cover.
I found myself having a hard time like psyching myself up to, while I really liked the first three, just like go down that road again because I felt like I knew exactly what I was going to get at this time. And I think this record does that for me, where it's just that kind of abrasive, in your face energy, politically and socially conscious in a way that is also kind of funny at times and amusing, but about trying to navigate this moment of existence as a somewhat sane and critical thinking person, but just with really awesome sounding guitars and huge hooks.
They were separating families carelessly.
Okay, I'm gonna go next. Largely because JP, I'm gonna pick yours for you. Sorry.
What?
All right, Rina Sawayama. We chatted about a little bit at the beginning. I mean, honestly, we should have just done a whole episode on this album, and maybe at some point we'll do a Rina episode.
She's your Charlie XCX. I mean, she's your hyperpop girl.
Yeah, she's Charlie XCX squared.
It's Rina, baby.
It is. Is it ever, for real? So this record is musically polyglot, astutely produced, and also, I assume intentionally, it's funny. It's a funny record. There are moments on this album where I just caught myself laughing, and I was like, am I in on the joke? Am I the subject of the joke? Am I the intended recipient of the joke? Is the song deliberately funny? Is it winkingly funny? Is it overt? Is it slapstick? I don't know. I'm still sorting some of it out. Let's listen to Comme des Garçons, Like the Boys, from Sawayama.
Comme des Garçons.
JP, will you preemptively forgive me?
What are you going to stick me with?
I'm going to stick you with Altecker.
We should do Leanne LaHavis. It's actually more fun.
Fine. You talk about Leanne LaHavis, then I'll go out with Altecker.
Okay, let's talk about an album that's just an album. That's not a 2020 album. It's just a song cycle about breaking up, falling in love, and breaking up again, which is the Leanne LaHavis album. It's her third album. She named it after herself. It starts and ends with a breakup song in the middle. She falls in love and it seems great, and then it doesn't seem great. The opening song is bittersweet, and it's just beautifully played. Every note is a surprise. Every note fits into a beautiful rhythmic grid. Throughout the album, she plays with time signatures. She plays with syncopation. Her voice is raw and poised and gorgeous. But anyway, let's remember what music was like before all of this weight was placed upon it, and listen to Leanne LaHavis's Bittersweet.
Oh. Sweet summer rain, I'm born again. All my broken pieces.
That's our show. We could obviously do this for 3-4 hours. We've left as much undiscussed as we did discuss. JP, Lindsay, a pleasure as always. I wish you a much more peaceful 2021. Maybe it'll be so much more enjoyable that you won't have 75 minutes in a row to listen to an album. Just a thought.
It's the dream.
You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Subscribe to podcasts. Anywhere you get your audio content, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, etc., etc. Get on the Facebook group. Email us, podcast@nytimes.com, with any questions. Tell me what your top 10s are, although I see some people posting it already on the group. Our producer, as ever, is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. Let's go out with some Alltagger, because I actually didn't love these records. The NTS sessions that came out, was that this year, JP? Or was it last year, the NTS sessions?
Last year.
Last year. So much great stuff in there. I found this stuff a little bit cold. I know it's cold by design, but I understand that. It just didn't quite totally connect for me. But I do think the people should hear it. JP, what do you want them to hear from Alltagger Sign?
I think we have to hear that instant classic, Metaform 8.
Yes, it's two words, meta with a Z, form 8 is the second word. Shout out to the name generator that made that name up. Very, very special. Here is Alltagger, Metaform 8. See you next week.
The South Dakota Stories, Volume 7. My trip to South Dakota was the best summer ever. Now I don't need to go to Mars, because I've been to the Badlands. And I caught a bigger walleye than Dad when we went to the Missouri River. Then I rode my bike through these huge rocks called needles. Ooh, I also saw my first herd of bison, even a fuzzy furry baby one. I can't wait to go back and see more. There's so much South Dakota, so little time.